You're listening to Doing It Right with me, Pandora Sykes, a podcast where I talk to experts about the myths, anxieties, and trends of modern life. In this series, Series 4, I'll be exploring topics including postpartum psychosis, sociopathy, and how technology has flattened personal taste. This is a podcast that asks, what can we do to understand life better? Not just for ourselves, but for everyone. For the first time ever, I'm dropping the whole series in one as a capsule box set. So tuck in and don't forget to let me know your thoughts at doingitrightpod@gmail.com. Corey Keyes is a sociologist and psychologist renowned for being an early pioneer of mental well-being. He's been researching his theories of languishing and flourishing for almost 20 years, but it wasn't until the organisational psychologist Adam Grant name-checked languishing in a piece he wrote during the pandemic, which became the New York Times' most read and shared piece of 2021, and I'll link that piece in the show notes, that Corey's theories became well-known outside of his professional fields. In response, Corey wrote a book, Languishing: How to Feel Alive Again in a World That Wears Us Down. But what is languishing? Well, explains Corey, it's feeling demotivated, aimless, without meaning or purpose. It's the absence of mental well-being. Sound familiar? You might be languishing. In this episode, Corey explains how we got to be in an epidemic of languishing, how it's different to burnout or depression, and the habits that can lead to a state of languishing, like passive entertainment, which I found particularly interesting as we are all streaming and scrolling our lives away right now. But it's not all doom. Corey also explains languishing's opposing force, flourishing, which is about not just feeling good, but functioning well. What does it mean to flourish? And how can we get there? I hope you enjoy the episode. Let's start at the very beginning. What is languishing?
Languishing is the absence of good mental health, or what I call flourishing. And I use the word flourishing because I found that people were confused when I used the word mental health. They thought sometimes I was talking about mental illness or mental health problems. So more than just the absence of mental health, languishing, there's a formal diagnosis, and you have to be deficient in at least six signs of what I call functioning well, and we can go over them, along with at least one sign of feeling good, or what I call emotional well-being. Languishing is a lot more than blah or meh. It's the absence of the very things that make our life meaningful. So I make that point because I think sometimes people confuse it with, well, you know, it's been raining here for 3 days straight, and, you know, I'm feeling pretty blah and bored. Languishing isn't being bored. It's a lot more detrimental than just being bored.
Although boredom is one of the things that can lead to languishing.
Yes, if you're disengaged for a prolonged period where you just feel, and that's actually what my colleague Adam was writing about in that New York Times piece. He found himself completely disengaged in the midst of a very important project. He had to finish up a chapter in his forthcoming book, and he could not get any motivation mustered, and he was completely bored. And so what he did was play games and binge watch movies.
This is feeling very familiar. I think when anyone thinks they have this elusive thing of writer's block, that's something that a lot of us turn to.
This condition called flourishing, which sounds like a luxury, isn't a luxury at all. It's where people can, it's the place where they're stronger and can deal with life and the slings and arrows in a way that we don't realize it. And I say the following because in one of my interviews, this person kept asking me the question, if there's so much languishing in the world, don't people just need to toughen up? And he kept coming back to that, and I didn't bite on it. And I finally told him, here's the research that suggests where people are tough: when they're mentally healthy, when they're flourishing. And I gave him all kinds of examples. I'm kind of tired of this narrative where if people aren't doing well, they're languishing or they're depressed. They just need to toughen up. And I'm like, I don't know.
Do you think flourishing is a form of resilience then? It's sounding like, not that they're interchangeable, but that that resilience is a large part of flourishing.
It's the place where we can deal with high demands, high stress. We can even deal with conflict. We can even experience negative moods because we experience stress in a day, but we don't let it disturb us for the rest of the week. It's a great place to be because life is both sweet and sometimes it's sour, but you don't let the sour overwhelm you. But when you're languishing, it's just the opposite. It's as if life gets under your skin, the negative stuff starts to take over, and people become weaker because they let it define them. And I'm tired of this world saying, well, we just need to toughen up. No, flourishing is a protection. It's a source of strength. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's a source of resilience. If you want tougher people, prioritize mental health. They're less likely to die premature. They're less likely to become depressed. They're less likely to develop PTSD in the face of adversity. Oh my God, I could go on.
I'm curious, why did you call the book Languishing and not Flourishing?
I have to meet people where they're at. And the pandemic made it very clear that you meet people where they're suffering. And it is a form of suffering. I hope I make that very clear in the book. That's not, and this sense of invisibility and dying inside, you've got to meet people where they're at and then leave them with hope and a path. So that's why. I needed it personally, Pandora, right? That's why my story's there. I needed a path and I needed hope. Otherwise, I would have given up on life a long time ago.
Yes, I like it when you say that your research is actually me-search.
Oh my God, it was. Yes.
I think that's the same for a lot of people, though, who do the kind of work you do. You're looking for an answer to something that very often has begun inside you.
Yes, and it's also, oddly enough, or maybe it makes sense, why people go into ministry and theology. They're seeking answers to the nature of the universe and the mystery of life and their own suffering in it.
But you're very keen as well to establish what languishing isn't, because obviously terms are so important now particularly. And you say that languishing shares a lot of traits with depression and it shares a lot of traits with burnout, but it is different to both of them. How is it different? And I was thinking when I was reading, does it have anything in common with ennui, or is that something different too, do you think?
Well, let's start with depression and work our way through this. I would beg to differ with your choice of words. This shares a lot of things in common. It's actually only one question in my diagnosis that overlaps with the way psychiatrists go about diagnosing depression. And languishing can include the loss of interest in life, and so can depression. But that's where the overlap ends. Depression is a lot about the presence or absence of some very negative signs and symptoms, sadness or a sense of hopelessness, and then a variety of signs or symptoms that you're simply not functioning well at all in terms of sleeping, eating, or thoughts about whether life is worth living. Languishing, all the questions I use are phrased positively about the presence of good things. When you're languishing, it goes well beyond a loss of interest in life. As I said, it can include a variety of things like loss of growth, autonomy, mastery, and acceptance of self or others, among other things. Burnout is very contextual to work, and it's this balance between stress and resources or stress and rewards for the amount of work you're doing. When you're experiencing a lot of demands at work and your resources for coping with them are low, or the rewards that you're getting for all the hard work you're doing are very low, you tend to score higher in terms of burnout. You become exhausted. And I think burnout can be a cause of languishing. I mean, I would admit working hard and getting very little recognition or reward or very little support can lead to languishing. Now, ennui, that I think there is some overlap with this sense of ennui. And I didn't write about it because I didn't feel I had a good enough grasp on it and what the French mean. And frankly, I didn't want to take on all the existential philosophers to tell you the truth, which could have led me down a rabbit hole, because I wanted to stay very situated in terms of psychology and sociology and public health.
You do compare it to the now forgotten Greek sin of, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation here, acedia, acadia?
Yes, you were correct in the first instance. At least that's the way I pronounce it, Pandora. Yes, acedia. In the ancient world, it was acadia. And yeah, the Greeks used that word, but it went way back, very, very early into the origins of Christianity. And I know it sounds ludicrous, but people have to believe us. There was an eighth deadly sin, and acedia was it. And when I read what people were describing, how it was sinful, I believe it definitely was. They were talking about languishing, because what it did was lead them to seek distractions from that unpleasant feeling and from their path. And that sacred path of Christianity and worshiping God and the word of Jesus.
You made me realize, actually, when you were writing about the deadly sins, that I actually couldn't name seven. I could only name envy and gluttony.
Gluttony. I think I myself am spiritual and formerly religious in a formal sense. I couldn't actually name all of them. Deadly sins today myself, and I wrote about them, and I list them in the book, of course, that I don't have memorized myself either.
We are in a loneliness epidemic. We were in one before the pandemic, and we're in an even greater one now. How can loneliness, and I don't just mean, or I think when a lot of people think of loneliness, they think being alone, which is absolutely not the same as loneliness. Loneliness can come from feeling alienated from society, from not feeling welcome in a shared space or in an outdoor space. You know, there are so many different ways in which loneliness manifests, I think, in contemporary society. How do you think they collude and encourage us to languish?
Loneliness is actually not directly measured but I would say indirectly measured in three ways when I measure the presence of flourishing. I ask people, do you have warm, trusting relationships in your life? And I also ask them, do you feel you belong to a community where you can derive a sense of comfort or joy? And the last question that gets at it is, are the things that you are doing on a daily basis contributing anything of worth and value to other people, your community, or society? And I describe loneliness in my book as the absence of at least one or the whole collection of those three things. You don't have warm, trusting relationships. You don't have a sense of belonging. And you don't have a sense that you matter to anyone and that you have anything to contribute to society. And so languishing for many people, certainly not all, because you don't have to have a deficit of all of the signs of flourishing, just at least seven out of the 14. But I suspect loneliness is baked into a lot of people's sense of languishing. But I make a point also in the book that loneliness rarely happens alone. And by that, I mean, right, we're in public health, we have this almost fetish for tackling one thing at a time, right? A Surgeon General, at least in our country, wants to be known for something. They want to have a legacy. And I understand that. So they take on one particular epidemic. Every one of them is known for one landmark thing they focused on. But here's the problem with that. As I said, tackle loneliness without also trying to understand that people are languishing in addition to having no sense that their life matters or in terms of having a purpose, that they're not being challenged to grow and become better people, that they don't like most parts of their personality or their self. I don't think you're going to be able to tackle the problem of loneliness, because when you don't have those three things that I talked about, belonging, contribution, and warmth and trust in your life, I don't think you feel motivated to connect with people because you don't have something valuable to sort of connect with, right? I think people connect when their life has a sort of sense of flourishing because they feel they have something meaningful to be part of and give as sort of a gift. So I think languishing puts you in a situation where you feel like, why would I connect? Why would anyone want to be with me? Because I feel dead inside and I have nothing to give.
I was fascinated, and you really put something into vocabulary for me here, by the idea of passive leisure being a precipitator of languishing and active leisure being the precipitator of flourishing. Can you explain a little bit about what passive leisure is and how it harms?
Well, passive leisure is literally when you sit down and consume what you think is taking a break from work, and you think this is a form of enjoyment. Watching TV is considered leisure by a lot of folks. Listening to a concert, nothing wrong with that. I love music and going to concerts, but it's considered passive because you're not involved in making any of the what's being consumed happen. Even storytelling, you can go out there and listen, or listen to a poetry read. Again, it considered passive in the sense that you're not producing some of what you're enjoying. Active leisure can be traveling as well. And so, or storytelling, being the storyteller or being the musician that makes music happen.
I'm interested to know if you think reading is passive or active.
I believe it fits more often than not in the active leisure category. And the reason I would say that is because immediately what I remembered when you asked me that question is a study of flow, the sources of flow, where you feel really engaged by what you're doing so much so that you lose a sense of time. And all the in this sense of feeling overjoyed and engaged is very high during flow activities. And reading was one of the prominent sources of flow. And so I would think it veers far more likely to active than passive. It can be passive, but I think it's far more active.
I'm so glad that you said that about reading, because I am an obsessive reader and I find it really restorative. And I was so worried that you were going to say it was passive. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, I have no hope of flourishing then.
Well, I was just going to reassure you, Pandora, in addition to helping people feel flow and engaged, reading has been connected to increases in curiosity, and especially reading fiction over nonfiction. I hate to admit that because my book is nonfiction, and I love to devour nonfiction and have rarely read fiction. But my wife is always reminding me of that and trying to entice me into the world of fiction reading.
I like to have one of each on the go. I feel like that's always quite a nice balance of palette, having a fiction and a nonfiction. You point out that at the beginning of the pandemic, local community really flourished, but when the lockdowns were over, most people saw it dissipating again. How do those micro pockets of interaction and those local ground level relationships help prevent languishing? Is it all just part of feeling like you belong, like you're part of something bigger, sort of the opposite of individualism?
I would agree with you, but I think what happened during the pandemic is that people realized the need for each other and that they felt more necessary to each other's well-being and connection. And the writer Sebastian Junger, who wrote this book Tribe, talks a lot about this, that the modern world is very hard on us because it makes most of us feel unnecessary to most of what goes on in the world. But here was something that affected almost everyone more or less uniformly. And what we had to rely on was the local contacts we had and to really help each other through this to the extent that we could without, you know, spreading the virus. But I think people felt, if only momentary during the pandemic, that they were necessary in ways that they hadn't felt necessary before that time.
You also mentioned that you'd begun work at a time where mental health was not even a concept. And I was just thinking when you were talking about the pandemic then, how much we talk about it all the time. But when you first started working, the only thing that existed was mental illness, so the absence of mental well-being, but not actually mental well-being itself. When did you see it becoming part of the conversation?
It really took about a decade of work that I had done. I felt kind of alone in this activity, and I was reminded by my colleagues that they thought I was going down a hollow road.
Really?
Oh, goodness. I was reminded constantly that I was not paying attention to something that was far more serious, which was mental illness. And there I was focusing on mental health.
What year was this?
This was in the early 2000s. I published the first formal paper on this mental health continuum in 2002. And during the first decade, people constantly reminded me in my discipline of sociology, they would use the derogatory term that, boy, Corey's focusing on happiness while the rest of us are studying serious stuff. And I wasn't just focusing on happiness. And by the way, I thought another way to look at the oppressive nature of society, which is what sociology does, right? How it creates cleavages and inequality and oppression and racism and sexism, and how the cost was to look at how it takes away all the good stuff, right? It sucks the life out of us. It takes away our purpose, our sense of belonging. But boy, I was reminded that I was focusing on something they thought was unimportant and should stay invisible. And then all of a sudden, after 2010, you started to see people start to realize, I think, because there was enough science out there, that there may be something to this flourishing thing. And suddenly more people were creating measures of it and proclaiming their loyalty, so to speak, to this new direction. But it was a very lonely endeavor. But I believed wholeheartedly that it was the answer for me personally. It was the place where I needed to be in order to stay in recovery, because it wasn't enough. All the pills and all the talk therapy could do for me one thing was lower the negative symptoms of my depression or my PTSD, but it didn't keep me in recovery. And I was looking for things that would help me move in the direction of feeling at home here. I call it flourishing my North Star in the book. And that's one of the reasons I believed in it wholeheartedly, just because personally, the more I focused on it professionally, the better I felt personally, because I prioritized those things in my life.
You believe that there are five vitamins of flourishing. What are they?
Well, helping, that is pro-social behavior, engaging in it, volunteering is another example. So go out and help somebody or something. Second, engage regularly in learning something new. Some of us think we're doing that every day, but we're doing it for the wrong reason. That is so that we do better at work or make more money. Go out and learn something new just because you want to learn it, because it brings you joy. Third, go out and play more or engage in active leisure. Fourth, connect. Now, everyone is talking about social connection, but I'm talking about prioritize warm, trusting relationships, belonging, or a sense of mattering. And last, engage in some form of what I'm calling transcended activities. That is, some form of spirituality or religious activities. And don't do the kind of spirituality we do over here a lot of, which is you do yoga or meditation, but you don't want all the garbage of the philosophy that comes with it, right? If you do yoga, you only do the poses. You don't study the yogic philosophy. If you do meditation, you don't want to talk about Buddhist Eightfold Path, because the research has shown that if you do that, you don't get the benefits of the spirituality. You need to focus on the spiritual content, not just the spiritual physical side of the activity.
Something we see a lot right now is the struggle to believe in something. Many people have turned to heterodoxy in place of organized religion. You mentioned earlier that you have moved from organized religion to something more spiritual. And a lot of people carry out health or wellness practices to have something to aspire towards, albeit when wellness is involved, it can mean something internal rather than external. And when I say wellness, I mean more the wellness industry. Is spirituality, whether religious or otherwise, a part of flourishing.
Yes. At least for people who engage in it in the way I was talking about, and even the religious side of the transcendence, you get the benefits when you make it a regular part of your life and practice it on a regular basis. So it has to be frequent. It has to be considered something that you use almost on a daily basis. I say almost. It doesn't have to be every day, but it's important to your life. And there's also this element where you have to prioritize the elements of spirituality and religion that are encouraging us to be a better kind of person, not just a better person than others. I talk about this distinction between becoming a better person for others versus becoming a better person than others. It's the former that's really key to benefiting from spirituality and religion when it comes to flourishing.
You also talk about how maladaptive perfectionism can lead to flourishing. And I found that super interesting, as it suggests that even the people whose lives look the most full are susceptible to feeling like they don't matter or they don't belong. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I use several examples in the book of people who have many of the external things that you think bring them flourishing. There's the woman on Oprah who talks about, I have a great house, a great family, I make a lot of money, I'm doing everything you would think outwardly, I'm a success. And yet I feel a void in the pit of my soul, an unsettling feeling. I even use the example of Leo Tolstoy, who at the height of his literary career, he's writing his Confessions. And there's a page where he's talking about these ink blots just falling on the page. And he keeps asking himself a question. Why? Why does this matter? He's talking about success, something he thought he wanted. And I think a lot of us think we want success externally. And when we get there, we realize it brings us some things, but not necessarily the things that give us our life's meaning and direction. And maladaptive perfectionism, to some degree, will drive you so hard that you could succeed in college and in your career. And yet the problem there is you can be so harsh on yourself. That's what makes it maladaptive. When you're not living up to your almost unattainable standards, you're not pursuing the next challenge or the next promotion or more money. And so the problem with it is that you can never rest content with what you have when you have maladaptive perfectionism and the external success. That, I think, is what drives a lot of people to be successful in their careers, but they're empty inside and they talk about dying inside. But there is this thing called adaptive perfectionism, which is that I have very high standards for myself. I'm going to work myself very hard. But when the time comes for rest, or when I've failed and I'm not doing quite as well as I think I should, I'm going to be compassionate to myself. I'm going to be kind. And I'm going to understand that I too am human. That's the thing about adaptive perfectionism. It loses the harshness, the self-criticism, the excessive, driven, unmet needs that can never make you happy. So I found it interesting that, yes, perfectionism can be good to flourishing as long as it's combined with compassion. When it's very harsh, you can succeed externally, but it comes at a cost of flourishing.
Corey, thank you so much. I've loved talking to you today and learning a little bit about your work. It's given me so much pause for thought, and I'm sure the listeners feel the same. So thank you.
You're most welcome. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Doing It Right. Don't forget, the whole of Series 4 is available to binge now. If you liked the show, please do give it a rating or a review on iTunes. And if you want to chat more about any of the episodes, you can email me at doingitrightpod@gmail.com. Doing It Right is presented by me, Pandora Sykes, with sound by Kelsey Bennett, and production by Pandora Sykes and Kelsey Bennett.